Joe, in researching this book, were there surprises uncovered to you, for you? And if so, what were some?
Well, probably one of the biggest surprises was the amount of airports that Coring Township had. Those that live in and around the area know about the Mount Healthy Airport, which was located at the corner of Springdale and Coring Avenue, basically where Northgate Mall is today. There were two other airports. There was one close to Pippin and Adams Road, and then there was one on the Clippard Farm that was your typical farmer's airfield or airstrip where you just sent in one or two seat little jobs and, you know, kind of did it for fun or for a hobby. The one that was called Lakewood Airport at Pippin and Adams Road was very, very interesting. The biggest thing that happened there was several Air Force jets that were doing some maneuvers and in training in the area ended up going into crisis mode when they started to run out of fuel, ended up landing there, with, you know, loaded to the gills with all their ammunition. They had to bring in techs to fuel them and to make them lighter. In other words, take away all the ammunition, you know, the missiles and whatever else that they were carrying, and ended up getting them into what is now CBG and then allowing them to take off and get back up to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So that's a neat little thing. Made it to the front page of the Cincinnati Enquirer in the early 1950s. And and that's really something you don't see today.
Today, the curiosity is black helicopters. Back then, those farmers were thrown for a loop to have these Air Force jets come through there.
Absolutely.
And the one that was about where Northgate is now, that's not anywhere near Mount Healthy. How did it get the name?
Well, according to the Coring Historical Society, essentially what you had was federal regulations at the time. The few that there were for airports and for aviation said that you had to register your airport to the closest municipal area. Now, Coring Township, like all townships in the state of Ohio, are unincorporated, meaning that you have very limited control over rules and regulations. So what you ended up having was Mount Healthy being the closest municipality ended up being the place where they registered it. So, you know, went by Mount Healthy Airport for a good majority of its existence.
And when did that airport close prior to them starting on Northgate Mall?
It was around the 1950s, early 1960s that you really didn't have too much going in and out. Like most of the airports, they saw a lot of action in the time period right after the end of World War II with a lot of guys coming back on the GI Bill and taking aviation courses. But pretty much after that, you saw it just kind of go dormant and go out of existence.
Visiting with Joe Flickinger, Joe's new book is A History of Coring Township, From Frontier Wilderness to Suburban Sprawl. Most folks know downtown on a bluff overlooking the river was Fort Washington way back in the day. I think to the west, there was one in North Bend. To the north was Fort Hamilton. Fort Dunlap. Tell us about Fort Dunlap in Coring Township.
I guess probably the biggest thing that we could say is that Fort Dunlap was not a fort in the way that we think of it. You'll hear it referred to as a station. It was a loose collection of homes organized in a way that they could defend themselves. There's really no evidence today whether or not there was the high picket fence that we think of with forts today. What you had was a number of individuals who went to the area looking for that opportunity that a lot of people came to the Cincinnati area were looking for, that opportunity to start over or start with something that could make them rich or, you know, at least make them prosperous. So Native Americans in the area, specifically the Shawnee, weren't real happy with many of us moving into the area. So a couple of small little attacks garnered a plea to Fort Washington from some of the inhabitants to send several, at least some protection in some way, shape, or form. So what they sent was a lieutenant with a small detachment of American troops from Fort Washington. About a week or so later, what they ended up with was a force of somewhere between 200 and 400 Native Americans. There's a lot of rumor and conjecture who the leaders were. Some say it was Simon Girty, one of those old individuals that you hear about in some of the old frontier tales. Others will say it was Blue Jacket himself. We don't really have a whole heck of a lot of documentation that says who it was, but nonetheless, they captured a settler, tried to get him to plead with the individuals in the fort to give up, saying they'd let you go. And what happened was, with the U.S. troops there, that bolstered their confidence. So what they ended up saying was, you know, no, we're not going to give up. We'll fight you off. After a couple of half-hearted volleys of arrows and some musket shots, they started to commence to torture the settler, whose name was Abner Hunt, and they tortured him right in front of everybody in the hopes that, you know, his cries and screams would get them to give up. That didn't happen. After a siege of about 24 to 25 hours, Abner Hunt's screams and cries kind of faded off in the nighttime. In the meantime, the Great Miami River, which was very, very close by to this fort or station, a couple of settlers had slipped into that under the cover of darkness and ended up getting down the river onto the Ohio River and getting into what is now downtown Cincinnati and Fort Washington. And they brought in a large crew of volunteers and as well as U.S. soldiers to scare off the Native American attackers. So when you talk about an attack, you know, that's closest to Cincinnati that what we can think of during the early 1790s.
But that wasn't a 2-3-6 hour battle. That went a few days, didn't it?
It was about 24 to 25 hours is what they're thinking. Now, it could have been they surrounded them for more hours. You know, we're going off of documentation written after the fact, obviously from people who were there.
Now, for those folks who made it through to the Great Miami, down to the Ohio, down to Fort Washington, and back, any idea what kind of time we're talking? Again, that wasn't a 2 or 3 hour trip.
No, no, it wasn't.
Especially upstream.
Exactly. They guesstimate it was somewhere right after dark that they were able to slip in. So most of the things that I've seen say somewhere between 8 to 10 hours in January.
Ouch.
Yeah, that was not a fun trip, no. I don't think.
No. So you said it was obviously close to the Great Miami. Can you pinpoint it anymore? I know the sign for Dunlap in that area out of Coleraine Avenue.
It's actually right off of East Miami River Road. Coleraine Township has built a park there. It's called Coleraine Heritage Park. Coleraine Historical Society's put an old toll house there, open for everybody to go see, as well as they're hoping to get an outline of where they think the fort was. I know in the 1960s, there were some archaeological digs in the area by the University of Cincinnati's archaeology. I think a professor and several students, all they found was a couple of musket balls and things like that. And the Coleraine Historical Society thinks that for the most part, it was a farmland afterwards. So, you know, with the soil being turned over and, you know, constantly being added to and amended, that a lot of the things that would have represented Fort Dunlap went by the wayside, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Throw out some of the important names from the early days of folks who got it up and running in the township.
John Dunlap was a member of the surveying party for John Cleve Sims. You know, John Cleve Sims is
the man.
He is the guy. If you were to look in an old deed and you would see federal government and then you see the lineage going on forward, a lot of our territory and a lot of our property would say John Cleve Sims.
Most all of it.
Exactly. Exactly. John Dunlap was the guy who helped to survey the land. He saw it as a major opportunity for a lot of people, including himself, selling a lot of land, things like that. Beavis was another family. There was a little hamlet in part of Coleraine Township that was named Beavis after the Beavis family. They had taverns and, you know, there was a lot of the family that lived in and around the area and were pretty well known to the general population of Coleraine Township. You also had names like Struble and a lot of the names that you might see on roads today. The Struble's a main road through the thoroughfare, and you have, obviously, Dunlap. And funny story about Georgetown. You don't see Georgetown on any of the maps anymore. It's not even a census-designated spot, but it was named after a number of Georges that lived in the area. So some of those early names have faded in the past for today, but some of them are still there and, you know, exist on the signs that we see today for streets.
Well, the subtitle of your book is From Frontier Wilderness to Suburban Sprawl. And it couldn't be more true. How that place has grown up, the township, Coleraine Township, was that 50s after the war when the real sprawl began?
Exactly. It was 1950s. If you were to look at a chart that shows the census populations, you see from 1820 going all the way forward, it's pretty steady. You're talking 5,000 people or less. You go into the 1940s, you see it go up a little bit, and you might expect that. You see a few small little clusters of homes that were built there, but 1950s and then 1960s, it goes up by 10, 15, 20,000.
Yeah, so quick, so rapidly.
It does. And all the problems that go along with that as well.
What about law enforcement in the area from the beginning? Who was controlling things to what do we have now?
Well, out in those areas, you would have a lot of, because it was out in the middle of nowhere, it made it difficult to get out into those areas. So with a lot of dirt and gravel mixture roads, a lot of the Hamilton County Sheriff's deputies didn't venture out into those areas unless it was to serve a warrant or to help with an investigation on something. You didn't see them go out there very often. So what you would end up seeing is what were called protective associations. And generally what it was these individuals who would get together, they heard a crime, maybe somebody stole a couple of horses or something like that. They'd send out the alarm and everybody get together, and you think about kind of the old West, you know, getting a posse, together and everybody set up roadblocks and things like that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they would offer rewards and they'd all contribute money together and things like that. So beyond that, the township would employ part-time constables. A lot of times they were to escort criminals through the area. Mm-hmm. It was for small little things, but they were never anything that was full-time. Then after that, a lot of times the protective associations would get deputized as special deputies by the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office. That was temporary going through the 1920s and 30s. And then you start getting into the suburban boom. And then you started to see more of the sheriff's deputies mm-hmm. be assigned to the area. And then Corrine Township got into the act and they got their police department started, which started off as very, very part-time constables. Mm-hmm. And then they started a police district and, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. You know, they started with their full-fledged police department.
That's Corrine Township. Previously, it was Greene Township. What township are you going to be exploring next? Do you have anything on the horizon?
Right now, no.
May I ask that you do? I love your books. They're fascinating.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Brian. I appreciate that. It's a real joy writing them. I like the areas that haven't really had a whole heck of a lot written about them. It gives something for someone in the future to be able to build off of, mm-hmm. maybe update, make even better than what I've put out. So I'm very happy that people have enjoyed the books, and who knows where the future will bring us in terms of new books and things like that.
And some good friends of yours were a lot of help in putting this together. Why don't you give the shout out?
Absolutely. The Corrine Historical Society was tremendous in their help and support with this. One of their trustees actually approached me right after I had released my Greene Township book, and they knew that I was a high school history teacher in the area. They said, we'd love to have somebody in our area write a book. So got the ball rolling, and over the course of the next 4 or 5 years after several more kids with my wife and I and going through the whole research process, they've been phenomenal with their support. Mary Burdett, who is their president, has done a fantastic job of just opening up their archives and saying, whatever you want, here you go. And if they don't have it, she can, or several of their other trustees or members have been good with, well, I think I might know so-and-so who okay. knows about that. So they've just been fantastic, as Greene Township was as well. So, you know, they've all been very happy to have someone come in and do a book on their area.
Fascinating stuff. Thanks and congratulations once again. It's a history of Corrine Township from frontier wilderness to suburban sprawl. With my guest, Joe Flickinger, and we'll put a link to your website at our website, wvxu.org.
Absolutely.
Thank you, always, thank you. Come back with another one, and don't make it too long.
All right. Thank you.
For Around Cincinnati, I'm Brian O'Donnell.